It's Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell, joined as always by David J. Lohr and David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels and Philip Michaels. And I'm very confused. Somebody's wearing a nun costume. Hi, guys. And nun.
I'm just glad I've always wanted to ask the musical question. Phil, how do we solve a problem like Maria?
Wait a minute. Am I Cagney or Lacey?
No, hey, is it Sunday? Because nuns,
Simon.
Nuns don't work on Sundays.
Oh, I think we're going to debate this later, friend.
Yeah, just a little bit.
This is season 2, episode 13, The Jororo Kill. It is the famous episode that has been memed on the internet where Magnum says to himself, wait, nuns don't work on Sundays, and then shoots a nun to death when she's standing on top of a ladder. Or is it that simple?
No, not that simple at all. There is basically a guy on Twitter. Do we know the account off the top of our head?
I sent it in the text.
You did, but I don't have that in front of me. Clearly, David, or I would have asked.
It's like the weekend that every day on Friday or every week on Friday does Ladies and Gentlemen the Weekend. Well, this is every week on Sunday. Nuns don't work on Sunday.
Yes, the one that I saw is a guy going, "Wow, 80s TV shows were wild," and basically, it's the second craziest thing that happens in Magnum, other than the bird attacking poor Tom.
Yeah, it's NUNSDNTWRKSUN. Nuns don't work on Sunday.
It is beautiful.
And that's this episode, The Jororo Kill, which begins.
Not a fun episode to talk about when you have a speech impediment, as I do. So
okay.
I'm just going to call it the
rural
episode.
Juror.
Thank you.
All right. Jororo Kill.
The Jororo Bill.
Jororo Kill. South of France, 48 hours ago. Again.
Yeah. There are no banyan trees
from when?
In the south of France.
Well, my first note is, tropical France. Great. Anyway,
yes.
There's a nun with a flat tire and a helpful gendarme. Oh, no. She has a remote control. Boom. A car blows up. It's an assassination attempt. Except
I don't remember that Madeline book.
Except then when she runs away and takes off the habit, she has short hair and maybe it's a man. But that's okay. Somehow there's a guy with a gun who immediately after the explosion knows to run in the right direction and find someone who was responsible and finds the habit, but not the nun.
Well, and this is my favorite moment in that scene. He sees the habit lying on the ground and he rifles through the habit and he pulls out a rosary and looks up like, oh,
God did it.
It really was a nun.
What kind of nun would do this?
One that works
Maria.
On Sunday. Okay.
Working overtime.
Anyway, Higgins has...
Sisters are doing it for themselves.
It turns out that Mother Superior truly did jump the gun. Beatles?
I got it. But David already did Eurythmics, so he's ahead of you with an 80s reference. So, wine cellar. Higgins has alarmed the cellar and says, release the nerve gas to Magnum as the battle of who gets access to Robin's wine continues. It's a 1836 Chateau de Maurice. Okay, you know, wine people, you can write in if you want to. I don't think 150-year-old bottles of wine are drinkable.
No.
Nope.
No,
nonsense.
Actually, at a certain point, any sort of liquor will just taste like paint thinner after a time. Because
it'll just go bad.
It goes bad, no matter how well you store it. They found some like Civil War era whiskey, and it was it turned you blind.
Turpentine.
Yeah, it's terrible.
That's not how it is. Anyway, Higgins is in a wine club. Once again, Higgins is a member of some sort of organization. However, this has the amazing line, another one. Oh, Higgins, what do you do in this one? The show is calling out the fact that Higgins is in a lot of clubs.
Yeah.
Take that, Higgins. Anyway, Kate called. She's at the club with Rick and TC and has a cane. Kate Sullivan is who this is. It's Tyne Daly. Now, the CBS television network, which aired Magnum on Thursdays at 8, 7 Central, you'll know as the home also of Cagney and Lacey, starring Tyne Daly and ultimately eventually
Sharon
Gless.
Sharon Gless, yes.
After some recasting of various points. This is actually, this episode aired a couple months before the series Cagney and Lacey debuted, so I feel like it might be a form of cross-promotion in a very soft way, like to get Tyne Daly's face on CBS on one of its hit shows a little bit in advance of her own show beginning. But for whatever reason,
they did
this
that
is
for years.
This is just before the series. There was a movie before of Cagney and Lacey, but this is just before the series debut on CBS. She's Kate Sullivan. She's a journalist. She knew them all in Vietnam, and she was wounded. She walks with cane. She's here because the president or the prime minister of the Jororo Islands, a fake country, is here on a state visit.
It's near Costa Nueva.
Yeah. Bye, guys.
What is the deal with CBS shows in the 1980s and their love of fake countries? Were they afraid of being sued by Nicaragua? Were they afraid of? Oh man, the Guatemalans are really angry at us today.
Samoa is angry with us now.
That's a tradition that goes back to Mission Impossible in 1968 on CBS.
I know it's Marvel. It's Latveria.
It's DC with all their asinine.
The West Wing had the fake countries in it.
Right.
I get it. You do not want to offend a real country. Or like have people who are, you know, from the diaspora of that country writing you letters. I understand.
So
it's just Jororo, huh? That's what you came up
Jororo.
With.
Jororo.
Jororo.
Jororo. Jororo.
So
he's also an X-Man.
So
Barbara Walters reporting live.
Tyne Daly is looking for a guy who's and rumor has it British intelligence is also looking for him, and that's why she's really there. We cut to Honolulu Airport. They mentioned the WikiWiki bus, which I really love because that's the bus that they take. You have to go from terminal to terminal. It's called the WikiWiki bus. They show a customs inspection station, and you might think, if you've never been to Hawaii, that this customs inspection station looks suspicious because it's kind of like a kiosk with some kind of crappy carpet on the wall behind it. And friends, I'm here to tell you this is totally what the airport looks like in Hawaii.
It is. Yep.
This is it. It looks like that. It doesn't make any sense. Anyway, our assassin is there.
Do you have any fruit with you?
Yeah.
Can't bring fruit onto the island.
Our assassin is there. Now, you know, this is a strange episode, very difficult to watch with modern eyes, because our assassin, it turns out, what we'll find out is a British intelligence operative who often went undercover dressed as a woman and apparently liked dressing as a woman a bit too much, appeared at a social function dressed as a woman, and was basically drummed out of the service, became an assassin, and still dresses as a woman some of the time, although not all of the time. However, the episode has decided that whoever this actor is who is playing this part cannot speak in a woman's voice, and therefore, whenever he speaks while dressed as a woman, his voice is dubbed in with the voice of a woman, which I'll tell you, that is a real talent. And
it is,
good,
it no, is very strange.
No wonder. No
that
wonder he is
work.
So good at as disguising himself as a woman, because he literally can change his voice into the voice of a woman dubbed in over his voice. So
I don't know if you've ever seen the clip on YouTube of Star Wars where it's David Prowse doing the lines as Darth Vader, but it is that kind of weirdness where your voice shouldn't sound like that.
Well,
only this was the final product instead of the one that they produced afterwards.
And you know, a network TV show in the early 80s is not going to handle issues of gender and society well.
Well, that's good that you're making that allowance, because boy, this one does not.
It does not. No,
and my notes, I actually wrote down the attitudes through the whole episode. Every time it comes up, it's literally just, ew, transvestite assassin.
Yeah.
Ew.
And even that is not, I mean, it's not as far to the fore as I think it could have been, and that I was relieved by that.
Well,
but what I find
worse,
we'll get to that.
Could have been much better.
What I find baffling, though, is that there's no reason for this to even be a plot point.
Nope.
There is a very weird scene later in this episode where after he primes like the bomb in a van in order to set up a thing that is a red herring. He goes back to the car and puts on a woman's blonde wig and puts on lipstick. And it is this moment that is never paid off, nor do we very rarely see the assassin dressed as a woman, not just as a nun. So it feels like it was a note, which is like, we really need to show how sick this guy is by having him dress up and put on makeup. So can you add that in there? And it doesn't go with the rest of the plot. And that's really my problem. And I'm glad they didn't handle it, because they would have mishandled it. But it's like, it shouldn't be part of this episode, because if you're going to do it, like, cast somebody who is arguably able to pull off this and do a voice and be this person.
Yes.
But once you start just dubbing in a woman's voice for this brilliant assassin who can just magically make his voice turn into a woman's voice, I don't know. It's just,
it's funny you should say, you know, how could it have been worse? We'll get to that. I have an example that ties in directly to this.
Okay. I can't wait for that that installment of Tales from Tales of.
You're spoiling.
Oh, is it really? Yeah. Okay, great. Okay.
It really is.
Oh.
Okay. Yeah, we'll get there. But anyway. That's later. But the note I have is that in this episode, you have this really interesting character thing going on with Kate. That is an interesting story.
Yes.
And it's a little bit different from what you always see, and a little bit, you know, it does tie in with the general Magnum thing of, hey, veterans, and mm-hmm. you know, this is tough. And you have it welded.
How do we have a woman character who still has bonded with the Vietnam veteran team?
Right.
And has burdens from Vietnam, in that she's got an injury and that she's got debts sort of to her people who helped her survive Vietnam. Really interesting. And then there's this nun thing that happens.
Well, you have this actress who has interesting chemistry with Selleck and very different from Margaret Collin and Mimi Rogers and Jane Delaney, but a really interesting character. And the arc that she goes through is really interesting in this. And you have it welded to one of the stupidest, dopiest, most... Awful, honestly, plot.
Since most of the plot points here involve the assassin being a nun,
yeah,
that's the other part of it. Is you could do this without the gender stuff,
yeah,
because a nun is not. It is easy for a slim built man to dress in a habit and be and pass as a nun.
Robbie Coltrane proved in Nuns on the Run, Jason.
Indeed.
You don't even need to be slim to pass as a nun.
Thank you. Yes, case closed, everybody.
Okay.
So that the fact that they kind of felt that they needed to amp it up, and yet it doesn't really have any, I don't know. It's like, I'm relieved that they didn't do more with it, because they would have horribly mishandled it. But at the same time, it does point out the fact that it should just not be in here.
It is so, as David says, it is so totally weird in this episode.
Yeah.
That gets into some heavy stuff.
Higgins,
about trauma.
Yeah, right.
And then on the other hand, it's,
transvestite
look
assassin.
At the guy who likes putting on women's clothes.
and Higgins says... Yeah. You know, he got drummed out by a sex scandal. It's the only kind we have, which actually on its own
That's
is a very
line.
Funny line about like the British,
yeah.
except showing up at an official function dressed as a woman is not really a sex scandal.
I think the scandal was he was wearing the same thing as the queen,
as the Duchess or whatever it is.
Outshone the Duchess.
Yeah, that actually was funny too, but they're like the sex scandal. Again, I don't know. Maybe the writers of this episode actually had some knowledge about people who were, you know, I don't even know if they had terms for this back then. But
it was a little too elbow in the ribs.
They did, because Barney Miller talked about it.
Yeah, but I would say, you know, I feel like the writers have some knowledge of gender and transgender issues when they wrote this, but they're writing it for CBS on Thursday night. So they gotta not really address it. And so you end up in this very weird situation, which I honestly, on one level, it might be about as good as you could expect from 1982, but
yeah,
it's not great.
I mean, you did have All in the Family already talking about it. You had Barney Miller talking about it and fairly respectfully for the 70s. So it wasn't like totally out there, but there is still so much of
and then
welding that to the nun thing, like Belisario has a whole Catholic strain through a lot of his works. And his, I think his one feature film that he made is called Last Rites with Tom Berenger as a priest who is tempted by Daphne Zuniga and all this stuff going on. And, oh, there are guns. It's terrible. But, yeah, it's a really strange blending of things.
Strange choices. So there is a scene here that I really like, which is that Rick and Mac are fishing. My note says it is the saddest thing ever. Because Mac can't go out in the water, so they're sitting basically on the back of a boat that is docked and fishing. And then Rick keeps buttering him up. Oh, nah, Mac, come on. This is the best fishing on the island. And then and that's funny but sad. And then they complain about Thomas. Oh, he bribed me with food. Say, you got a beer? And it becomes, I actually really liked it, where we know that Rick is, because Magnum is like, I know I can't talk to Mac, but I'm taking care of it. And so Rick is doing it. And Mac is so oblivious, and it's delightful, where he's like, but you and me, Rick, we're not like Magnum. Hey, you got some food? You got some drinks?
Well, and there's a great line that Mac has, and I wrote it down. Never have I met a man who takes more advantage of his friends than Thomas Magnum. And then Rick is like, well, you know, yes, I get it. Yeah, but could you look up this guy?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that scene.
Oh, no, it's nice. It's wonderful. It's basically Thomas's two big patsies forming the Patsy Union. Except we realize that Rick is the head patsy in charge, because he is playing Mac like a fiddle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's punching down.
Yeah.
It's fine.
It's funny.
They're drinking Coop's beer again.
The assassin drives into an area, shoots a security guard who dies.
Coop's beer from Cooperado? Wow.
Shoots a security guard and he dies instantly from a shot above the belly button, which I found, like, I don't think that's how shooting works, that you just immediately die when you're shot in the belly.
He's that good of an assassin.
Anyway,
he can change his voice.
Drags him into a shed that says danger explosives, and it blows up. And that's so the assassin is on the case and doing stuff, whereas Tyne Daly is interviewing the very, very extremely boring Jororo prime minister. But she gets a phone call during her interview with the prime minister from her editor, which I find really funny because, hey, Phil, you and I have done journalism.
Yeah. Sometimes by accident, but sometimes
on purpose.
Phil all the time in the middle of things.
I'm trying to imagine a scenario where you get an interview with a head of state and your editor calls in the middle to check up on other stories you're working on. I just
say, Jason, remember that time you interviewed Steve Jobs?
Oh, when I had to put him on hold because the call waiting came in because somebody wanted to ask me what my sandwich order was.
Steve Jobs, how's that going? I just wanted to check in on you.
Yep.
Make sure you get that Steve Jobs interview done. Okay, just wanted to let you know we're behind you, buddy.
I'm very sorry. That was my editor. He's a moron. Anyway,
and at that point, Steve Jobs cursed you out and hung up on you.
Yeah.
So it's not that far from the truth.
The thing that jumped out at me with this call is, now it's not the same voice, obviously, but it's the same terrible ADR and same terrible volume. And you go, oh, it's the assassin.
It's the assassin, yeah. Yeah. Magnum is now suspicious of Kate a little bit. His little voice is telling him things. We had a voiceover and all of that. Let's see what the computers don't lie. There's a guy with hair and sideburns and he's like, oh, there's no prime minister here. No, at the hotel. But then he calls after Magnum leaves and he's like, aha, like they're on the lookout. But there's a guy. Now let's talk about the doorman at the hotel.
The doorman. Yeah.
Because he thinks Magnum wants to get information on girls or gambling. But Magnum uses his magic touch to be like, but no, I'm the hotel detective. And no, it's fine. It's cool. I'll just let you off with a warning, but tell me where the Jororo delegation is, which is a good piece of detective work on Magnum's part, followed by a terrible piece of detective work, which is He gets to the fourth floor, and they're like, no, this floor is closed. So he goes down to the third floor and then goes right up the stairs, at which point, like, they're like, yeah, we knew you were going to do that, dummy. Come on, Magnum.
But the other nice thing about the doorman, that's Zulu from Hawaii Five-0.
From Hawaii Five-0, play the doorman.
Formerly Kono Kanakawa.
Get your girls, get your gambling info.
And he's lovely. He's a great bit part.
It's a fun little bit, right? Where he's like, oh no, now I'm going to get fired. And Magnum's like, no, you're not going to get fired. You're just going to tell me what I need to know, and then it'll be fine. So again, hey Phil.
Yes.
You've done journalism.
I occasionally.
When you're interviewing with a head of state, do you ever have it where you're a private investigator friend comes by and you just take a break from interviewing the head of state to go talk to your private investigator friend? Because that's what happens with Tyne Daly. She's like apparently in the middle of her interview when she comes out and talks to Magnum for a little while.
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I've ever been in that situation, Jason. I have interviewed Jerry Brown, and I've interviewed other folks here and there. Bud Melman once in a limousine. But no, I would say that I generally do not go and say, can you hold on, former Governor Jerry Brown? I need to go talk to my good buddy David, who wants to show me the Legos he's made of our interview.
Yeah, I didn't take – when I interviewed Cesar Chavez, I didn't say, Cesar, now this is the end of part one of the interview, but I'm going to go over here to another room and have a conversation with somebody. Then you just wait here. I'll come back for part two of our interview. I didn't do that.
And and hang on, Cesar, because I've got this picture of a Lego version of you. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And some Lego grapes.
Anyway, you know, Magnum figures it all out. This is the moment where Bannister, who's the assassin, does some nonsense with the van and then goes rides a bike and then changes into a blonde wig. There's a call for Kate. It's not going to happen to Monday. It turns out that the popular front of Jororo hired Bannister to kill him. Wow, Jororo is kind of hard to say, Phil.
That Jororo corridor is amazing.
Oh, man. The Jororo corridor. Woo.
The rural parts of Jororo.
David Brinkley would hate saying Jororo.
So then,
welcome to Jororo.
A perplexing bit of journalism. Hey, Phil, you know, you and I have done some journalism over the years.
I keep hearing this, and yet I'm not convinced.
When you get a source that tells you that there's going to be an assassination on your subject, the Prime Minister
rarely
Jororo,
comes up in tech reporting, I do have to say that.
Do you think that your response would be, let's not call the police yet? Because that's what Tyne Daly says to Magnum.
Yeah.
To which Magnum says, well, I'll tell you what, I won't call the police, but you will. Yeah, this bad journalism is what I'm saying.
Yeah, normally I get kind of irritated at Magnum PIs like constant journalists. They're not very good at anything. And yet, here, I kind of have to side with Magnum that Tyne Daly really, really kind of sucks at her job here and should go back to being a police detective in New York.
Yeah, that's solid, I think.
Or follow her brother's career path and become a licensed pilot in Nantucket.
So they find that van.
Uh-huh.
And Magnum thinks, this is too easy.
Well, there's no detonator. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't make a mistake like not putting a detonator in the explosives.
It's all a setup.
Also, Magnum looked at his watch and said, there's 20 more minutes of episode left.
So in the end,
and I haven't seen any nuns
what he does
yet.
Is he calls to like the CBS television network and has them feed a tape of Vietnam so that Kate can remember when she was a good journalist.
That is a well-written little piece.
And we also get tape of Bannister, and she realizes that that's the voice of her source. Ha ha, it's all been a setup. But guess what, people? Santos, the Prime Minister of Jororo, has gone to a private mass at Our Lady of the Holy Veil, a convent.
Because it's Sunday.
Because it's Sunday, and you know what happens on Sundays? All the nuns, they go to work. Let's and therefore, here it comes. The assassination attempt is going to happen at Our Lady of the Holy Veil. Up comes Bannister the assassin, dressed as a nun again.
He Santos gets introduced to all the nuns.
Yes.
There are only four.
It's a very small, well, it's a private
not
mass.
Well, yeah.
It's a private mass.
Head of state.
We have, let's see, I wrote this down. We have Sister Mary, Sister Faith. They take a long time with this. Sister Anne.
Yep, sure.
And Sister Barbara. And all I could think was, it's a good thing they didn't reverse it, because then all I would be thinking was, Barbara Anne.
So, sorry to interrupt you, David. The Bannister has just come on the premises and has shot.
Oh my God!
As a nun, and has shot somebody with a silencer. The guy who is shot to death with the silencer actually begins to turn away before being shot. So it's sort of like he got hit in the arm or something, I guess. But
well,
it's probably fatal.
He was anticipating his eventual demise because he had a fortune cookie the night before that said, "You will be shot at a private
by
mass.
A nun."
By a nun
in bed,
and then
I am glad to see that they paid off the beginning, because this is one of the few times you actually have Chekhov's nun.
Oh,
you're welcome.
It was right there. So Bannister comes into the church up in the balcony, set up assembling the rifle to do the assassination on the prime minister. Then there's the moment where Magnum and company arrive, and they go, "Oh, the balcony!" And somebody sort of spins around to look and is shot, but they do protect the prime minister, and that means it's time for the nun to go on the run. Magnum is chasing. He pulls a gun, but it's the wrong nun. And that leads us to that fateful moment where there's a nun on a ladder at a screen on the side of the convent. And Magnum thinks to himself and says out loud to the audience, "Wait a second. Nuns don't work on Sunday." Gunfight! Shot the nun. Nun drops to the ground. It's a memeable moment in the future. And this brings us to our new segment.
Mm-hmm.
Ask a Catholic.
Yes! Can I sing my theme song?
Yes, please.
Please do.
Holy See or Antipope, don't just stand there like a dope. Better Ask a Catholic. Better Ask a Catholic is brought to you by the Lutheran Church. Kind of like the Catholics without the ritual.
And joining us for this very, very special segment is Phil's wife and Catholic, Lisa Schweizer. Lisa, welcome.
Yay. Oh, it's good to see you.
She's
oh, my God.
Not here.
What? Why isn't Lisa on Magnum Podcast, Phil?
Because she is putting our daughter to bed.
Oh.
Tried to pick her and say,
What?
Can you
can anybody help us with Better Ask a Catholic then?
Well,
is there a Catholic in the house?
I mean, fortunately, I was born Catholic and the son of a Catholic theologian. I could probably answer.
Okay. Do nuns work on Sundays?
Yeah. Yeah, nuns work on Sundays.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is it their most? It might be their most important. Do they climb ladders and work on screens on Sundays?
If the screen is broken,
there's
no rule against nobody else.
It's not like breaking a Sabbath or something where you're not supposed to do particularly.
No, not at all.
No, it's a busy day on a Sunday, right? It's a busy day.
If there's a need, you know, you serve where you are needed. And when you are needed. And, you know, maybe if you feel bad about it, you say a couple of Hail Marys and Our Fathers afterwards. You know, they all have the rosaries in the pockets, as the assassin did, because, you know, he's a method assassin. But, yeah, nuns work on Sundays. I mean, it's like the busy day of the week. It's the big day.
Yeah,
that's when all the masses are.
It seems like, from what I got talking to my wife who stiffed us, that, you know, there really are no on and off hours for the nuns. They do not clock out and then, like, rip off their wimples and suddenly it's like go-go dancers. No, they put in the time where the time is needed. And if they need to be up on a ladder doing some work on a Sunday, they're gonna do that.
Yeah, I mean, they've gotten into the habit.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Long way to walk.
Well, thanks, Lisa. And that ends...
You're welcome.
Better Ask a Catholic.
Whether you're a skeptic or you're a truther or that jerk named Martin Luther, better ask a Catholic. Catholic church.
This episode ends with Magnum and Kate having a drink. He's wearing a very nice sweater, and there's a callback to the tear gas thing, and that's the end of the episode. So there.
Now you ask, could this have been worse?
David, is it time for Tales from the Gold Monkey?
Tales from Tales of
oh,
the Gold
yes,
Monkey.
That's
but
right.
Yes,
sure.
Yes.
We are going to have to nail down the name of that segment if it's going to keep coming back.
Remind me to
make a memo in our production meeting, which doesn't happen.
You know, it's a fan favorite segment. Maybe the fans can name it.
Sid, what do you think of this segment?
Because, I mean, of is
You're
in
the only
title
one
of the
listening.
Show.
Magnum at theincomparable.com. Send in your notes.
So, but yes, it turns out the following year, much as Simon and Simon borrowed a script from Switch 8 years before, Tales of the Gold Monkey, mm-hmm. also a Don Belisario show, borrowed this script and paid the writers again for an episode called Nakajima Kill, in which a female reporter with a past connection to one of our main characters comes to the island to interview the defense minister of Japan. And her assistant, see, this is where it gets quote unquote original. You still have an EU transvestite assassin, but this time the transvestite assassin is her photographer. So he's totally involved all the time. Also badly dubbed with a woman's voice. But the real trick is he wears Katharine Hepburn-style pantsuits. And let's see, who did this? Sort of like the little turban scarf head thing, which doesn't actually make him look all that feminine. It's a little odd. But then you have the hero's sidekick, Corky, played by Jeff McKay, formerly Mac. Corky is sweet on the photographer, and Corky is going to get his heart broken. And the hero's dog is allergic to the fake foam that the photographer uses to pad out curves
and
such.
No.
And that's how they figure this out, because the dog is sneezing every time he's near the photographer. And of course, our hero realizes, oh, wait, Jack is allergic to foam. What? Okay. So I mean, that's bad enough, right? You're already kind of beyond the Jororo Kill thing, and you don't even have the interesting backstory. The interesting backstory for the reporter is that she and Sarah Stickney White went to Radcliffe together. And Sarah has always been jealous of her because she's interviewed Franklin Delano Roosevelt and all these people. And of course, the reporter's like, no, it's Delano. I should know. I've interviewed him so many times. The reporter is played by Kim Cattrall.
Oh, wow.
Currently on the rise from Porky's at that point. And so the whole thing, you go, all right, that's bad enough. How do we make it worse? We take it to the island of the Dragon Lady Princess and her ninjas, where they are all going to be very, very exotic and oriental, even though oriental is really described describing furniture, and they should be described as Asian, but the shows aren't making that distinction in 1983. Yep. And, you know, oh, let's watch as he grabs a fish out of her tank and then slices it and makes this exotic thing where they eat it right there. It's raw fish. Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah, it is amazingly awful.
So Belisario and Andrew Schneider, who are credited for this script, are also credited for that script.
Yeah, they literally just paid. I mean, Don paid himself, Schneider was paid for that.
Given how this show, however, the Jororo Kill has so many credited writers. It's got four credited writers.
It's like four, right? Yeah.
I wonder actually if this is a pre-existing script that was adapted twice again.
Possibly.
Out of the trunk. Because given that Belisario and Schneider are the only credited writers across the two versions, if they truly bought this script, unless they bought like a first draft or something and punched it up, It may be that it was just something that was in the tank somewhere, and then both of these shows ended up using a version of it. But it is very
weird. Well, and this is back in the days when you could still be a freelancer and make a living as a writer for various TV shows. And you would get the Writers Guild journal, and in the back of the journal, there was the TV market list, and it would list shows that were open to anyone to submit, open for just freelancers, open only to agented writers. I mean, there was this whole, you guys had baseball cards. I had the Writers Guild journal as a child. Mm. That was my thing. I knew all the codes and all the stuff. And so, you could submit a script and they might buy it over the transom and say, yeah, we're going to revise it and rewrite it a little bit. We're going to make it fit.
I'm baffled that this thing got made twice, though. That's just...
Yeah.
It seems really odd.
The third credited writer on the Gold Monkey script, Tom Green, is the one who actually wrote it for Gold Monkey.
Yeah, very clearly.
And he does a commentary on the DVD
given that Ruben Leder and Sutterfield, who are also credited on the Magnum episode, are not credited on that, one of two things happens. Either it was a Belisario and Schneider script that they had done that got pulled into Magnum and then they resold later, or they filed a draft and then it got rewritten by Leder and Sutterfield, and then from there it became the Jororo Kill. Because four writers to write this episode of Magnum PI, let me tell you.
Whoever, it is a very schizophrenic episode because of the whole Kate plot, which is not in Gold Monkey at all.
That's
the assassination plot.
That's probably what Leder and Sutterfield wrote.
Yeah. And yes, you do have a connection between one character and the reporter, but it's totally different, and it's very, very girly jealousy as opposed to anything else. It's a very shallow kind of thing. It's like, oh, I'm not going to eat the peanut butter sandwich because I already had breakfast. Oh, well, you're just a coward. What is this? Well, it's nonsense. But anyway,
and that's
tales of
the Gold Monkey. And that brings us to the end of the Jororo Kill, other than to say that Season 4, Episode 11, The Jororo Farewell, was written as a sequel to this episode.
What?
Why?
They had loose ends to tie up.
No. Yeah,
so many loose ends. Why? So many other uncomfortable things to write about.
Yeah, what happened to the guy who's the head of security for the Prime Minister? I hope we see him again, played by a different actor.
He turned into John Saxon.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, that wraps up, I think, this episode of Magnum Podcast. Any final thoughts before we go?
The only note I have left that I have not used in my draft is an homage to Christopher Durang. Sister Mary Ignatius executes it all for you.
Yes. I think the real friends were all the Jororos we met along the way.
Oh, nuns don't work on Sunday. This has been the Magnum Podcast. We'll be back again next time. But until then, David J. Lohr, Philip Michaels. Bye, guys.
Getting ecstatic and sort of dramatic and doing the Vatican rag.
In nomine patri.
Bye, everybody.